Welcome to Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park. Today you'll be touring Chancellorsville, one of the great battles of the American Civil War. More than 30,000 men were killed, wounded, or captured in 5 days of savage fighting here, martyrs to the beliefs they held dear. The silent woods and fields you'll see today are a memorial to their unfailing courage and devotion to those beliefs. This podcast will take you on an extensive tour of the battlefield, lasting a minimum of 2 hours. It can take much longer, however, depending on how many signs you read or how many trails you choose to hike. At each stop on the tour, you'll receive a description of the fighting at that particular site, followed by instructions to the next stop. While taking this tour, you'll see lots of brown circular battlefield tour signs. Do not heed those signs. They relate to a different tour. Follow instead the verbal instructions on this podcast. To reach the first stop on the tour, leave the Chancellorsville Battlefield Visitor Center parking lot by the exit closest to the building. Turn right and go 0.8 mile to the end of the road. Turn right there onto Ely's Ford Road and travel 0.5 mile, at which time you'll see a brown sign on the right side of the road marking the Chancellor House site. Pull into the parking lot there and stand so that Ely's Ford Road is in front of you and the highway is to your right. Stop 1, Chancellorsville. The Battle of Chancellorsville occurred in an area known as the Wilderness, a vast tract of heavily wooded land south of the Rapidan River. Hazard Stevens, a Union officer, described the area as a gently undulating tract of low ridges and swampy swales covered with a dense second growth of small pines intermixed with oaks and containing matted underbrush in patches almost impenetrable. It is from 10 to 12 miles across in any direction, he wrote. The main road, which traverses it, and a few clearings, widely separated, let but little daylight into the dense, gloomy, and monotonous woods. Here in the heart of the wilderness, four major roads of the region met. To your left lies the Orange Turnpike, now known as Route 3. On its crushed stone surface, heavily laden wagons of the 19th century carried goods between the tidewater port of Fredericksburg, 10 miles ahead of you, and the Piedmont town of Orange, Virginia, 28 miles behind you. Three other roads met the turnpike here. River Road is just out of sight in the woods ahead of you. It swung north and followed the Rappahannock River east toward Fredericksburg. Ely's Ford Road, which you just traveled, ran from this point north to the Rapidan River, 5 miles to your left. Across the turnpike, on your right, is the Orange Plank Road, which, like the turnpike, was a major east-west trade route connecting the towns of Fredericksburg and Orange. The plank road derived its name from the fact that one half of its surface was covered with wooden planking to support wagons during wet weather. From this point west, behind you, the turnpike and the plank road became one, only to diverge again 2 miles away at Wilderness Church. To your right, near the stoplight, is the foundation of Chancellorsville, the house from which the battle derived its name. Originally opened in 1816 as an inn for travelers, the building served as the private residence of Mrs. Sanford Chancellor and her 6 daughters during the war. The hospitality of the mother and the charm of her daughters attracted many Confederate officers to the house, including Cavalry Commander Jeb Stuart, whose troopers guarded the river crossings. The main Confederate army then lay encamped near Fredericksburg, holding the line it had successfully defended the previous winter. In command of the army was General Robert E. Lee. Lee had led the Army of Northern Virginia for less than a year, but in that short time he had gained a reputation as a bold and skillful strategist. He would need all of his ability in the upcoming campaign, for on the eve of the battle, Lee could muster just 60,000 men, fewer than half the number of his adversary's army. That force, the Union Army of the Potomac, was camped in Stafford County, across the river from Fredericksburg. Its leader was General Joseph Hooker, Fighting Joe to the press, a man of high courage and low morals. He had assumed leadership of the army in January and would be fighting his first battle as its commander. Although the army had poor morale when Hooker inherited it, he quickly whipped it into shape. By springtime, he boasted that it was the finest army on the planet. By mid-April, Hooker had devised his strategy for the campaign. Leaving a detachment of the army under General John Sedgwick, opposite Fredericksburg, to hold Lee's attention, Hooker would lead the rest of his army on a 40-mile march beyond Lee's left flank and descend on his rear here at Chancellorsville. Then, with his army both in front and in rear of the enemy, he would advance and crush the Confederate army like a walnut in the jaws of a nutcracker. Meanwhile, a 12,000-man cavalry detachment under General George Stoneman would swing south of Fredericksburg, severing Lee's communications with Richmond. Outflanked, outnumbered, and without supplies, Lee would have no choice but to retreat. Hooker was confident of success. "My plans are perfect," he boasted, "and when I start to carry them out, may God have mercy on General Lee, for I will have none." Initially, it appeared that Hooker would make good on that boast. Brushing aside Confederate cavalry, the Army of the Potomac crossed the Rappahannock and Rapidan Rivers to your right and advanced here to Chancellorsville. Hooker now had Lee right where he wanted him. "The rebel army is now the legitimate property of the Army of the Potomac," he told reporters. "They may as well pack up their haversacks and make for Richmond. I shall be after them." In an order to his army later that day, he crowed, "The enemy must either ingloriously fly or come from behind his entrenchments and give us battle on our own ground, where certain destruction awaits him." Hooker's bragging bothered some officers, but most shared his confidence. When Union troops broke camp here on the morning of May 1st, they did so with enthusiasm. Marching past the Chancellor House toward Fredericksburg, they plunged into the dark, forbidding woods of the Wilderness. What lay beyond those woods? Victory or defeat? A few hours would tell. The advance of the Union Army followed three roads. Two divisions of General George Meade's V Corps took the River Road on the Union left. Meade's remaining division, led by General George Sykes, comprised the center column that marched along the turnpike. General Henry Slocum's 12th Corps headed toward Fredericksburg along the Plank Road, beyond Sykes's right flank. The 2nd, 3rd, and 11th Corps remained here as a general reserve. We'll follow the route of the Union Army's center column, led by George Sykes. To do that, turn right out of the parking lot and proceed to the stoplight. Turn left onto the Orange Turnpike, modern Route 3, and drive 2 miles, when you'll see a brown sign marking the first day at Chancellorsville Battlefield. Go just past that sign and take the next left. Carefully cross the median strip and park near the small red building you'll see on the other side. Stop number 2, the May 1st Battlefield. After breaking camp at Chancellorsville, General George Sykes led his division eastward along the Orange Turnpike, modern Route 3, toward Fredericksburg, 7 miles ahead of you. If Hooker expected a bloodless victory at Chancellorsville, he was mistaken. Lee had no intention of retreating without a fight. When he learned that a large Union force had crossed the river to his rear, Lee dispatched General Thomas J. Stonewall Jackson to meet the threat. Sykes clashed with Jackson in this vicinity. Unaware of the size force he faced, Sykes formed a line of battle astride the turnpike here and prepared to give battle, confident that the rest of Meade's corps on his left and Slocum's corps on his right would soon connect with his line. Because the roads on which they were marching diverged from the turnpike, however, Meade and Slocum had fallen behind the center column, leaving Sykes to face Jackson alone. The Union general quickly found himself not only outnumbered, but also outflanked both on the left and on the right. After a short fight here, he prudently withdrew his division to the ridge 1 mile behind you and called on Hooker for reinforcements. The fight for Chancellorsville had begun. This portion of the battlefield is owned by the Civil War Trust, a nonprofit organization dedicated to preserving endangered battlefield land. The Trust has created a wonderful 3-mile-long trail that explains the May 1st fighting. The trail begins near the cluster of signs, should you wish to take it. Otherwise, return to your car, turn right onto the highway, and drive 0.8 mile to the next ridge. As you approach the top of the hill, you'll see a brown National Park Service sign directing you to the Chancellorsville Battlefield Visitor Center. Turn left at the top of the hill just after you see that sign. The turn comes up quickly, so be careful and be sure to put your blinker on. Carefully cross the eastbound lane of Route 3 and drive 1/4 mile when you'll see a brown sign that says McLaws's Line. Pull into the small parking area there, face the Tor Road, and turn your player back on. Stop number 3, McLaws's Line. After engaging Stonewall Jackson's troops where we last stopped, George Sykes withdrew his division to this imposing ridge and called on Hooker to send up reinforcements. Instead, the Union commander ordered Sykes to give up the ridge and withdraw to Chancellorsville. He was retreating without a fight. Chief Engineer Gouverneur Warren tried to persuade Hooker to change his mind, but the order stood. Sykes was to withdraw at once. Reluctantly, the general ordered his men off this ridge and back to the low-lying ground around the Chancellor's home, 1 mile behind you. As the Union Army retraced its steps, the confidence of morning gave way to bitterness. "If we can't hold the top of a hill," George Meade fumed, "we certainly can't hold the bottom of it." Henry Slocum, too, was incensed. The 12th Corps commander was about to engage the Confederates along the Plank Road, 1 mile to your right, when orders came from Hooker for him, too, to fall back to Chancellorsville. "Our movements up to the arrival at Chancellorsville were very successful and were well planned," Slocum later commented. "Everything after that went wrong, and Fighting Joe sunk into a poor, driveling cur." By mid-afternoon, the Union Army was back at Chancellorsville, 1 mile behind you. The Confederate Army cautiously pursued it as far as this ridge and entrenched. The lines were drawn. Battle would begin in earnest on the morrow. Throughout the battle, the ridge where you're standing was held by General Lafayette McLaws's division of the Confederate Army. For 3 days, McLaws's men sparred with Union troops on the rolling ground behind you. An interpretive trail that covers that phase of the fighting begins at the trailhead marker at the edge of the field, should you wish to take it. Otherwise, get back into your vehicle, turn right onto the Park Tor Road, and drive 0.4 miles to the Orange Plank Road, modern Route 610. Just before you reach the intersection, you'll come to a pull-off on the right. Stop there and turn your player back on. Stop number 4, the Lee Jackson Bivouac. In olden times, the road that you're on was called the Furnace Road, because it led to an ironworks called the Catherine Furnace. Intersecting the Furnace Road at this point was the Orange Plank Road mentioned earlier. Chancellorsville was on the Plank Road and is 1.2 miles to your right, while Fredericksburg lies 10 miles to your left rear. Henry Slocum's 12th Corps advanced down the Plank Road, right to left, on May 1st, encountering Jackson 1 mile to your left. Before Slocum could engage Jackson in battle, however, Hooker ordered him to return to Chancellorsville, where his corps formed the center of a new 6-mile-long defensive line. The Confederates pursued Hooker to this point. Richard Anderson's and Lafayette McLaws's divisions of the 1st Corps entrenched here, along the Furnace Road, while the 3 divisions of Jackson's 2nd Corps camped along the Plank Road, 1 mile to your left. Lee had roughly 2/3 of his army here at Chancellorsville, having left 12,000 men under General Jubal Early to hold the line against John Sedgwick's forces at Fredericksburg. Lee and Jackson met at this crossroads on the evening of May 1st. While their staffs waited at a respectful distance, the two warriors seated themselves in front of an open fire just across the road and discussed what course of action they would pursue the next day. Jackson expressed the opinion that the Union Army would withdraw across the river during the night. The entire movement, he believed, was merely a feint to draw the Confederate Army away from Fredericksburg. But Lee didn't agree. Hooker's main strength was in front of them at Chancellorsville, he contended, and must be attacked. But could they attack the Union Army with success? Lee dispatched engineers to scout the enemy lines. Their report was not encouraging. Hooker's army was dug in along a 6-mile line, running from the Rappahannock River south to Chancellorsville, thence west toward Wilderness Church. The Union left flank, resting on the river, obviously could not be turned. And a frontal assault against Union log works in the center of the line, even if successful, would entail more casualties than Lee could afford to lose. The only remaining possibility was an attack on the Union right. There, the prospect of success looked more favorable. Cavalryman Jeb Stuart had scouted in that direction and reported that the Union flank was up in the air. That is, it wasn't resting on any natural defensive barrier, such as a hill or river, nor was the line refused or bent back to receive an assault. Furthermore, Stuart reported that Union trenchments there appeared to be weaker than on other parts of the Union line. But was an attack there feasible? The Union flank was several miles away, and to reach it, Lee and Jackson would need a suitable network of roads. The roads had to be close enough to the Union lines so that marching Confederates could reach the enemy flank in a day. Yet they had to be far enough away from the Union lines that the movement would not be detected by enemy scouts. Did such roads exist? Jackson sent members of his staff to find out. Late that night, his mapmaker, Jed Hotchkiss, returned with good news. He had found a feasible route. The generals watched intently as Hotchkiss carefully traced the route on a map with his finger. Lee then turned to Jackson and asked what he intended to do. Retracing the same route that Hotchkiss had just indicated, Jackson replied that he planned to advance along that route and attack the Union Army. "How many men did Jackson intend to take with him?" Lee asked. Without hesitation, Jackson replied that he intended to take his entire corps. The boldness of the proposal stunned even Lee. Jackson's corps comprised 30,000 of the 45,000 men that the Confederates had at Chancellorsville. That would leave Lee with just Anderson's and McLaws' divisions, 15,000 men, to confront Hooker's force of 70,000. If Hooker discovered that the Confederates had divided their army, he could easily fall upon Lee's tiny force, destroy it, then turn and strike Jackson. The Confederate army, and with it the Southern cause, might be dealt a fatal blow. The risk was great, but the opportunity was greater. Lee agreed to Jackson's plan. The next morning, May 2nd, Jackson's three divisions marched past this intersection and headed west, the direction you now face, down the Furnace Road. As they did so, they passed under the watchful eye of Marsh Robert, who was soon joined here by Jackson. The two generals conferred briefly. Stonewall then pointed toward the head of his column and was gone. The two men would never see one another again. Carefully cross the plank road and continue straight ahead for 0.8 miles to the Maury birthplace. Pull into the parking area there and turn your player back on. Stop number 5, the Maury birthplace. Surprise was essential to the success of the Confederate plan, but surprise was among the first things lost that day. Union troops at Hazel Grove, 1 mile ahead of you, saw Jackson's column as it passed over this ridge and opened fire on it with artillery. Hooker himself was notified of Jackson's march shortly after 9 a.m. At first it puzzled him. Spreading a map out on a bed at the Chancellor House, he muttered, "It can't be retreat. Retreat without a fight? That is not Lee. If not retreat, what is it?" Then the answer came to him. "Lee is trying to flank me." Immediately, he sent a dispatch to General Oliver Otis Howard, commanding the troops on his right flank, warning him of the danger. By 11 a.m., the entire Union Army knew of Jackson's march. Before leaving the stop, you may wish to take a short walk to the birthplace of Matthew Fontaine Maury, one of America's most illustrious scientists. A path leads through the woods to the foundation of the Maury family home. Once you've seen the house site, return to your vehicle and continue down the Furnace Road for 1/2 mile when you'll come to a fork in the road. Bear left at the road fork and proceed a short distance to the Catherine Furnace parking lot, which will be on your left. Back into the lot so that when you stop, you are facing the Furnace ruins. Stop number 6, the Catherine Furnace. In front of you stand the ruins of the Catherine Furnace, one of Spotsylvania County's earliest industries. Built in 1836 by Charles Welford Sr., this was one of several iron furnaces that existed in Virginia prior to the Civil War. Production here halted in 1846 due to falling iron prices, but it restarted during the war. It remained in operation until 1864, when troopers of General George Custer's Union Cavalry destroyed it. Jackson's column passed the furnace from right to left on its march toward Hooker's flank. At the head of the column rode Charlie Welford, the son of the furnace owner. Charlie would act as Jackson's guide that day, leading him through the forbidding woods toward the Union Army's flank. At the head of the marching column was the 23rd Georgia Volunteers, a regiment of approximately 500 men. When the column reached this point, Jackson pulled the 23rd Georgia out of line and sent it into the woods 1/2 mile to your right to shield the gray column against a possible Union thrust from that direction. This precaution proved wise because Hooker was planning just such an attack. After warning General Howard to protect himself against a flank attack that morning, Hooker had had a change of heart. Upon reflection, he concluded that the Confederates were not trying to flank him, as he had earlier supposed, but that they were retreating toward Gordonsville, Virginia. His conclusions, if hasty, were not unreasonable. He outnumbered Lee more than 2-1, and if Stoneman had cut the railroad in Lee's rear, as Hooker supposed he would, what else could Lee do but retreat? Hooker accordingly put aside all ideas of defense and instead made plans to attack the retreating foe. At noon, he pulled General David Birney's division out of line, 1 mile to your right, and sent it south to harass Jackson's march. Birney advanced through thick woods and swamps, engaging the 23rd Georgia at about 2 p.m. in the woods to your right. The outnumbered Georgians delayed Birney until the rear of Jackson's column had passed the furnace, and then fell back past this point to the embankment of an unfinished railroad, 1/2 mile to your left. There, they continued the fight until they were overwhelmed and captured by Birney's men. By then, other Confederate units were rushing to the scene. Robert E. Lee sent two brigades down the Furnace Road to threaten Birney's left flank, in the woods behind you. At the same time, the last two brigades in Jackson's column turned around and hastened back to the furnace to contain Birney in the area to your left. Confronted by these sizable detachments, Birney halted his advance and awaited reinforcement. Before the day ended, nearly 20,000 men would be sent to his support. Most of those troops, like Birney's division, came from the center of the Union line. By sending them south, Hooker unwittingly isolated the 11th Corps, which was guarding his right flank. When Jackson struck later that day, the 11th Corps would have to fight him alone. To follow Jackson's flank march, turn left out of the parking area and follow the gravel roads south. The roads that Jackson used were nothing like those you'll be traveling today, although they follow roughly the same route. Instead, they were narrow woodland paths, barely wide enough for a wagon. In 0.6 mile, you'll come to the site of the Welford House, where General Jeb Stuart had his headquarters. Nearby stands the bed of the unfinished railroad, where the 23rd Georgia made its final stand. Park signs identify those locations. Continue along the gravel road for another 2.2 miles to the Brock Road, modern 613. As you approach the intersection, stop your vehicle and turn your player back on. Stop number 7, the Brock Road. After 2 hours of marching, the head of Jackson's column arrived here at the Brock Road. The most direct route to Hooker's flank was to move north along the Brock Road, to your right. However, that route would expose Jackson's men to observation by Union pickets. The general therefore ordered his troops to proceed in the opposite direction, to your left, and then double back along a more concealed route. Continue to follow Jackson's flank march by turning left onto the Brock Road. Proceed 1/4 mile, and then turn right onto the gravel road, now called Jackson Trail West. A brown National Park Service sign marks the turn. Follow this road 2.3 miles to its junction with the Brock Road. Once you reach the junction, turn your player back on. Stop number 8, Jackson Trail West. After 6 hours of marching, the head of Jackson's column reached this point about 2 p.m. A mile ahead lay the Orange Plank Road. Jackson's plan was to advance down the Orange Plank Road and strike the Union Army's exposed right flank in the vicinity of Wilderness Church. But when Jackson reached the Plank Road, he was met by General Fitzhugh Lee, whose cavalry brigade screened the march. Lee asked the general to accompany him on a ride down the Plank Road. He cautioned the general to bring just one orderly with him, as they would be in view of the enemy. Jackson complied, and the three men galloped down the road 1.7 miles to the Burton Farm. From there, they were able to look down upon Howard's 11th Corps, which was spread out in front of them along the turnpike. The Union soldiers were relaxed, obviously unaware of the Confederates' approach. What Jackson saw was not entirely pleasing, however. From the Burton Farm, he could see that Hooker's line extended much farther west than he had anticipated. An attack up the Plank Road, therefore, would not turn the enemy's flank, but would strike obliquely across its front. To gain the Union Army's flank and rear, the Confederates would have to continue marching up the Brock Road 2 miles farther to the Orange Turnpike. Not only would that add distance to the march, it would also delay the attack until late afternoon, possibly jeopardizing the advantage of surprise that the Confederates had gained. Should Jackson alter his plan or not? It was a difficult decision, but the general did not hesitate. Turning to the courier, he sent a message back to General Robert Rhodes, whose division led the march, ordering him to cross the Plank Road and follow the Brock Road all the way to the turnpike. Could Jackson conceal his troops from Hooker a few hours longer? After a day of hard marching, would his troops still have the stamina to deliver a successful attack? And if they were successful, would they have enough time to exploit their advantage before darkness brought an end to the fighting? These and other questions must have weighed heavily on Jackson's mind. But if they did, he showed no signs of it. Returning to the Brock Road, he scribbled a short note to Robert E. Lee. "General," the note read, "the enemy has made a stand about 2 miles from Chancellorsville. I hope, as soon as practicable, to attack. I trust that an ever-kind providence will bless us with great success." We'll now continue to follow Jackson's march. Turn left onto the Brock Road and drive a little over a mile to the Plank Road. Jackson and Fitz Lee turned right at that point and rode to the Burton Farm. We'll keep straight ahead, however, going 1.5 miles farther to the Orange Turnpike, modern-day Route 3. When you reach Route 3, turn right and get into the left-hand lane. In 1.6 miles, you'll see two yellow traffic signs indicating a turn in the road. Just beyond those signs is a left-hand turn lane, and a break in the median strip. Make a U-turn there and get into the right-hand lane, being very careful of traffic. You'll immediately see a sign with a National Park Service arrowhead on the right side of the road. Turn right there and follow the gravel road to the cluster of historical signs. Walk over to those signs and face the highway. Stop number 10, the 11th Corps flank. You're now standing within the lines held by General Oliver Otis Howard's 11th Corps. The 11th Corps was unique in the Army, half the men in the Corps being Germans who had emigrated to America prior to the Civil War. Fond of beer and often profane, the Germans had little in common with General Howard, their pious, teetotaling non-German Corps commander. Howard's line extended along the Orange Turnpike, ahead of you, for a distance of 1.5 miles. The Union soldiers had built shallow trenches on the far side of the road, and in front of them had thrown up a barrier of trees and brush, called abatis. The Corps' right flank lay in heavy woods a short distance to your right. General Charles Devens, who led one of Howard's 3 divisions, was in charge of that part of the line. Although it was Devens's duty to protect the Army against flank attack from the west, he had just 2 regiments facing in that direction. The rest of his line fronted south, the same direction that you're now facing. On Devens's left, in the vicinity of Wilderness Church, stood the division of General Carl Schurz. Beyond it, on Schurz's left, was the last of Howard's 3 divisions, that of General Adolf von Steinwehr. There was a large clearing around Wilderness Church. Otherwise, most of this area was heavily wooded. When the 11th Corps first reached Chancellorsville, it was several miles away from the Confederate Army and in no great danger of attack. But that changed on May 2nd, when Howard received a dispatch from Hooker warning him that the enemy was moving in his direction. By then, Howard's own scouts had observed Jackson's column slowly making its way across his front. Howard assured Hooker that he was taking measures to resist an attack on his flank, but the only significant measure that he took was to turn some of his artillery in that direction. Beyond that, he did nothing. Howard's negligence in not taking additional precautions stemmed from the belief that the wilderness's dense thickets protected his corps from attack. Like Hooker, he believed that the Confederate movement represented a retreat toward Gordonsville rather than a flanking movement. The sound of artillery fire to the south and reports that Union troops had engaged the Confederates at Catherine Furnace seemed to confirm that view. Contradicting those reports was information supplied by Howard's own men. Around noon, Devens's officers reported seeing a large Confederate force moving around Howard's flank, to your right. Incredibly, Devens ignored this and subsequent warnings. One officer, Colonel John Lee of the 55th Ohio Infantry, rode to the general's headquarters 3 times that afternoon to implore Devens to turn his division west to meet the threat. Devens did nothing. But if Devens was negligent that day, he was no worse than his commander, General Howard. Like Devens, Howard received several warnings that afternoon about Confederates massing on his flank. But like Devens, he chose to ignore them, believing them to be the exaggerated reports of inexperienced pickets. In one instance, Howard accused an officer who brought such a report of cowardice and ordered him back to his regiment. Meanwhile, Stonewall Jackson was forming a battle line 1/2 mile to your right. His line was more than 1 mile in length and stood astride the turnpike, perpendicular to Howard's flank. Jackson had 3 divisions, which he stacked one behind the other. His attack, when it came, would fall on Howard's corps like an avalanche, engulfing anyone who stood in its way. It took Jackson 2 hours to get his troops into line. Finally, at 5:15 in the afternoon, he gave the order to advance. For Union soldiers, the first evidence of the attack occurred when frightened animals, deer, rabbits, and squirrels, came bounding through the woods, driven from their lairs by the advancing gray lines. Union soldiers, not immediately comprehending the cause of this phenomenon, cheered. Hardly had they raised their voices, however, when the bark of Confederate artillery sounded on their flank. Bugles echoed through the dark woods, followed by the shrill cry of the rebel yell. Stonewall Jackson was upon them. Union soldiers hastily grabbed their rifles and took their places in line. But most of the regiments faced south, not west. Before they could turn to meet the enemy, the Confederates were upon them, firing down their line. Some Union regiments broke ranks and fled. Others attempted to fight, only to find themselves outflanked and overwhelmed. Within minutes, Devens's entire division was in flight down the Orange Turnpike. General Howard grabbed a flag and tried to rally Devens's troops, but few men heeded his cry to stop. The panic was too great. Carl Schurz commanded the division next in line to Devens. Because he was farther away from the Confederates, Schurz had more time to prepare his troops for the attack. As soon as the shooting started, he deployed his brigades into a line facing west, toward you. He was able to muster no more than 4,000 rifles, which he positioned in the clearing around Wilderness Church. But his division alone could not hold back the torrent of Confederates headed his way. Within minutes, Jackson's onrushing Confederates outflanked and overwhelmed Schurz's men, who joined Devens's troops in their stampede toward Chancellorsville. Jackson's men were at their heels. "The whole affair from the moment of attack was a wild scene of triumph on our part," wrote a Confederate officer. "Hungry men seized provisions as they passed the camps of the enemy and rushed forward eating, shouting, and firing." Throughout the affair, Jackson remained near the front, urging soldiers forward and ordering officers to keep control of their men. In response to Jackson's command to press the enemy, one young soldier shouted exuberantly, "General, they are running too fast for us. We can't come up with them." "They never run too fast for me, sir," Jackson replied. The 11th Corps made one last stand beyond Wilderness Church, but within minutes, that line crumbled too. In less than 2 hours, Howard's entire corps had been routed and driven from the field. The door to Chancellorsville, and perhaps Confederate victory, was wide open. Return now to the highway. Turn right onto Route 3, and immediately get into the left-hand lane. Traffic is very fast on this road, so leave yourself plenty of room. In 3/10 of a mile, you'll come to a break in the median strip. Make a U-turn there and proceed east on Route 3. In 2 miles, you'll see a sign for the Chancellorsville Visitor Center. At that point, turn in the opposite direction, to the right, onto the park road known as Stewart Drive. As soon as you are on Stewart Drive, pull onto the shoulder of the road and park. Step out of your vehicle and face to the left, the direction of Jackson's attack. Stop number 11, Jackson's wounding. Once it had routed the 11th Corps, little stood between the Confederate Army and Chancellorsville, 1 mile ahead of you. Henry Slocum's 12th Corps, which had occupied the center of the Union line earlier in the day, had moved south to your right, leaving this area free of Union troops. Jackson was thus squarely in the rear of the Union Army. His plan was to march his victorious troops up the Bullock Road, across the highway to your left, and place himself squarely between the Union Army and the river, thereby forcing Hooker to attack him. Jackson was confident in his ability to beat back such an assault. "My men sometimes fail to seize a position," he had once declared, "but to defend one, never." Yet much of Jackson's corps was in no condition to carry on the fight. Hunger, fatigue, and disorganization had taken their toll on the Confederates. Generals Robert Rhodes and Raleigh Colston reported that it would take several hours to reform their jumbled divisions. Jackson had no intention of delaying his pursuit until then. He ordered General A.P. Hill's Light Division, which was in reserve, to take over the advance. Rhodes and Colston could follow when they were ready. Jackson's orders to Hill were concise. "Press them, Hill," he said. "Cut them off from United States Ford. Press them." At the head of Hill's column was General James Lane's North Carolina Brigade. When Jackson arrived at the front, he found Lane forming his men in line of battle astride the plank road. You were near the center of Lane's line. Jackson slipped through the forming gray ranks and rode out beyond the Confederate line on a personal reconnaissance. Accompanying him was a small cavalcade of staff officers, couriers, and signalmen. It was then 9 p.m. The horsemen were now between the lines, and some of Jackson's companions began to fear for his safety. "General," asked one, "don't you think this is the wrong place for you?" "The danger is over," Jackson brusquely replied. "The enemy is routed. Go back and tell A.P. Hill to press right on." The group continued forward through the darkness. Several hundred yards beyond their lines, they stopped. Ahead, they heard the voices of Union officers barking out commands and the sound of men busily wielding axes, picks, and shovels. The enemy was entrenching. Hill must attack without delay. With a tug of the reins, Jackson turned his horse toward friendly lines. As the group approached Lane's position, near the site of the modern Chancellorsville Visitor Center, Confederate soldiers to your right fired shots at a Union officer who had ventured into their lines. Confederate soldiers here, nervously imagining that they saw enemy soldiers in the shadows ahead, discharged their rifles too. The rifle fire spread across the plank road to the area where Jackson and his party were making their reconnaissance. By then, the horsemen were within 100 yards of the Confederate line. Stray bullets began clipping the branches around them. An officer on Jackson's staff rode forward shouting, "Cease firing! You're firing into your own men!" from the darkness came the reply, "Who gave that order? It's a lie, boys. Pour it into them." The flash from a long line of muskets lit the air and sent scores of missiles winging on their deadly flight. The volley ripped through Jackson and his party, injuring both riders and horses. Jackson was struck 3 times. One bullet lodged in his right hand, while 2 others smashed squarely into his left arm. The general's horse turned and bolted through the brush, wild with fright. Tree limbs struck the rider in the face, nearly throwing him from the saddle. Yet somehow Jackson managed to hold on, eventually turning his horse toward his own lines. Officers, rushing to his side, helped the injured general down from his horse and propped him up against a tree. He could not remain there, however. With the battle threatening to resume at any moment, it was imperative that Jackson be removed to a place of safety. Staff officers placed the general on a stretcher and carried him to the Plank Road, Route 3, reasoning that they could travel more quickly on the road than through the woods. That decision nearly cost them their lives, for just at that moment, Union gunners swept the road with canister. So dangerous were the blasts that the stretcher bearers had to lie down beside the road to escape injury. The cannon fire had a different effect on Jackson, who, roused from his stupor by the sound, propped himself up on his right elbow to look around. A hand on his chest shoved him back to the earth, and a voice whispered in his ear, "Sir, you must lie still. It will cost you your life if you rise." At length the deadly fire shifted, and Jackson's party left the road to seek the protection of the surrounding woods. That proved little better, however, for just moments after entering the brush, one of the carriers tripped over an exposed root. The stretcher fell from a height of about 5 feet, sending Jackson crashing to the ground. The general's wounded arm began to hemorrhage. His assistants lifted him back onto the stretcher and continued their journey to the rear. Late that night, doctors removed Jackson's left arm at the Wilderness Tavern, 3 miles behind you. When Lee heard the news, he was greatly distressed. "You have lost your left arm," he later wrote to Jackson, "but I have lost my right." Continue south on the Park Road for 0.4 miles and stop at the Confederate artillery position at Hazel Grove. Walk over to the cannons and stand facing the corridor through the trees, the same directions the cannons face. Stop number 12, Hazel Grove. With Jackson's wounding, leadership of the Confederate Second Corps fell to its senior division commander, A.P. Hill. Just minutes after Jackson's injury, however, Hill too was wounded. That left the Second Corps without an experienced leader. Robert Rhodes was next in line for command, but he was fighting his first battle as a division commander. He could not be expected to effectively wield an entire corps. Fortunately, someone remembered that Jeb Stuart was operating with his cavalry near Ely's Ford. Although a cavalryman, Stuart was a leader of proven ability and had the Army's confidence. Few men have been asked to take command under such trying circumstances. Stuart arrived at midnight in the middle of a battle to face a foe twice his strength. His troops were tired, hungry, and disorganized. He knew little about the position of Jackson's troops, and even less about that of the enemy. He did not even know what Jackson and Lee expected him to do. In an effort to answer this last question, Stuart dispatched Jackson's chief of staff, Sandy Pendleton, to the Wilderness Tavern to seek instructions from Jackson. "For a moment," wrote the general surgeon, "it looked as though he might succeed. His nostrils dilated, and his eye flashed its old fire. But it was only for a moment. His face relaxed again, and presently he answered very feebly and sadly, 'I don't know. I can't tell. Say to General Stuart that he must do what he thinks best.'" Lee was of greater help. Just before dawn, a staff officer galloped up to Stuart's headquarters with orders from the commander-in-chief. Lee wished to reunite the divided wings of his army and drive Hooker into the Rappahannock River. Stuart was therefore to attack down the Orange Plank Road toward Chancellorsville, at the same time extending his right flank so as to link up with Lee's forces near Catherine Furnace. To do that, Stuart would first have to capture Hazel Grove, the small but important ridge where you now stand. Occupied by Union soldiers of Daniel Sickles' Third Corps, the ridge stood squarely between Lee and Stuart. The outcome of the battle would hinge on whether Hooker could maintain his hold on this ridge. If he could, Lee's forces would remain divided, and Hooker would be in position to destroy them one piece at a time. If not, Lee could reunite his army and deliver a concerted blow that might force Hooker back across the river. Jeb Stuart recognized the importance of Hazel Grove, and at dawn ordered General James J. Archer's Tennessee Brigade to seize it. Archer's men moved forward at first light up the western face of the ridge, behind you. As they moved toward the crest, Union pickets opened fire. Archer's men quickened their pace. Driving back the enemy skirmishers, they gained the summit, only to discover Union forces evacuating the hill. Hooker had given up Hazel Grove without a fight. Continue along this road for 100 yards or so, when you'll see a road angling off to the left. Follow that road to its end. There you'll come to a sign describing the Fairview walking trail. Park facing the sign and turn your player back on. Stop number 13, Fairview. The open field in front of you was the site of Fairview, one of several small farmsteads that dotted the wilderness landscape. On May 3rd, the farm stood at the center of Hooker's defensive line. The Union general had some 40 cannon here that faced west, to your left, to meet an expected assault by Stuart down the Orange Plank Road. The crescent-shaped pits that protected those guns are visible in the field ahead of you. Throughout the morning, Hooker's guns here dueled with Confederate guns on the Plank Road and at Hazel Grove. Caught in a three-way crossfire, the Union guns here took a pounding, but continued to hold their ground. Meanwhile, Union infantry engaged Stuart's Confederates in the woods to your left. For 5 hours, the fighting raged. In that time, 18,000 men fell, one for every second of combat, making May 3rd one of the deadliest days of the Civil War. The battle here went back and forth, but around 9 a.m., Union ammunition began running low. The Union commander in the sector, General Henry Slocum, asked Hooker to send him fresh troops, or at least to supply his tired troops with more ammunition. Hooker did neither. Although he had both the 1st and 5th Corps waiting in reserve, Hooker did not wish to commit them to battle. Slocum was on his own. Before leaving the spot, I encourage you to take Fairview's short walking trail. When you're ready to resume your tour, go to the end of the road, turn left, and proceed to the top of the hill. There you'll come to another road fork. Turn left again and drive 0.7 miles to the ever-present Plank Road, Route 610. Turn left for a third time and proceed to the stoplight marking the intersection of Route 3. Pass through the intersection and turn left into the parking area beyond at the Chancellor House site, which you visited at the start of this tour. Park head in, facing the open field. Stop number 14, Chancellorsville. You're now back at Joseph Hooker's headquarters at Chancellorsville. When Hooker had arrived here on April 30th, he had no idea he would be here so long. Having outmaneuvered Lee in the early stages of the battle, he fully expected his opponent to retreat toward Richmond. Instead, Lee gave Hooker battle at Chancellorsville, prompting the Union commander to fall back here and entrench. On May 3rd, Lee attacked Hooker's position. Anderson's and McLaws division, supervised by Lee himself, attacked Hooker's lines from the southeast, your left and rear, while Jeb Stuart, now in command of Jackson's corps, assailed the Union line from the west, ahead of you. As Hooker was struggling to parry these blows, a shell struck the porch pillar on which he was leaning. The column collapsed, injuring Hooker, who for a few hours had to relinquish command of the army to General Darius Couch. By then, the Chancellor House was in flames. Unaware of their peril, the Chancellor family and other civilians huddled in the basement for protection. They might have perished there had it not been for Lieutenant Colonel Joseph Dickinson of Hooker's staff, who rescued the terrified group from the inferno and led them to safety. Meanwhile, General Couch sought to extricate the Army of the Potomac from the closing trap. At Hooker's orders, he evacuated this clearing and took up a new defensive position 1 mile to your right rear, closer to the Rappahannock River. As the Federals pulled out, victorious Confederates surged into this clearing, followed shortly by Lee and his staff. "The scene," wrote Colonel Charles Marshall, "is one that can never be erased from the minds of those who witnessed it. The troops were pressing forward with all the ardor and enthusiasm of combat. The white smoke of musketry fringed the front of the line of battle, while the artillery on the hills in the rear of the infantry shook the earth with its thunder and filled the air with the wild shrieks of the shells that plunged into the masses of the retreating foe." To add greater horror and sublimity to the scene, Chancellor House and the woods surrounding it were wrapped in flames. In the midst of this awful scene, General Lee rode to the front of his advancing battalions. One long and broken cheer hailed the presence of the victorious chief. He sat in the full realization of all that soldiers dream of, triumph, and as I looked upon him in the complete fruition of the success which his genius, courage, and confidence in his army had won, I thought that it must have been from such a scene that men in ancient days rose to the dignity of gods. It was indeed Lee's finest moment as a soldier, the culmination of a long and successful career. but the Grand Commander had no time to reflect on the significance of the moment, for just then he learned of a new threat to his army. John Sedgwick, whose corps Hooker had left at Fredericksburg, had brushed aside the Confederate force confronting him and was advancing on Lee from the rear. Once again, Lee was forced to split his army. Leaving Stuart with 20,000 men to hold Hooker at bay here at Chancellorsville, Lee led McLaws's and Anderson's divisions toward Fredericksburg, met Sedgwick in battle at Salem Church, and forced him back across the river. With Sedgwick out of the way, Lee then returned to Chancellorsville, intent on finishing off Hooker once and for all. But he wouldn't get the chance. Fighting Joe had had enough. When Lee's soldiers advanced to attack Hooker's army on May 6th, they found it gone. The Union Army had recrossed the river under the cover of darkness, bringing the campaign to a close. Chancellorsville has been called Lee's greatest victory, and rightly so. Initially surrounded by a foe twice his strength, Lee, by skill and boldness, had inflicted nearly 18,000 casualties on the Union Army and forced it back across the Rappahannock River. Victory came at a stiff price, however, for Lee himself lost 13,000 men, including Stonewall Jackson, who died at Guiney Station on May 10th, 8 days after his wounding. Without Jackson, triumphs such as Chancellorsville would no longer be possible. The road that might have led to victory now turned ominously north toward the Pennsylvania town of Gettysburg. This ends your tour of Chancellorsville Battlefield. I hope you've enjoyed it. To return to the Chancellorsville Battlefield Visitor Center, or to go to Wilderness Battlefield, return to Route 3 and turn right. To go to Fredericksburg, Interstate 95, or Salem Church, return to Route 3 and turn left.